From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Back in 1985, Joe Kane agreed to write about a group of explorers trying to make the first end-to-end trip down the Amazon. But Kane was only one of two adventurers who completed the journey, and it nearly cost him his life. On this edition of Fresh Air, Down the Amazon with Joe Kane. Also today, we go north of the Arctic Circle. Roy Amalek tells us about his family's and his people's tradition of whale hunting. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews some new reissues of Sir Thomas Beecham conducting Haydn symphonies. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg shares his thoughts on the push to preserve proper English. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Doreen McAllister. Czechoslovakian President Václav Havel told a joint meeting of Congress today that his nation welcomes U.S. help after decades of Soviet domination. But the former dissident playwright said eventually Europe must decide for itself how long American and Soviet troops should remain. After his congressional address, Havel returned to the White House to finish discussing economic and trade issues with President Bush. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said the two didn't get to all the items yesterday. A planned mini-summit of six African nations, including South Africa, has come under strong attack by anti-apartheid groups. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.
South African President F.W. de Klerk was invited to the unprecedented meeting scheduled for Saturday in Zaire, the first meeting between independent African states and South Africa. The ANC wants the Organization of African Unity to block de Klerk's attendance. Today, activist Albertina Sisulu said while blacks are still demanding an end to apartheid, African heads of state should not meet de Klerk. She said anti-apartheid organizations consider the summit with South Africa a stab in the back. The South African government considers the invitation a reward for unbanning political organizations and releasing ANC leader Nelson Mandela, and sees the meeting as a step toward opening diplomatic relations, including trade, with its African neighbors. I'm Phyllis Crockett in Johannesburg.
In Iran, a newspaper published by allies of President Rafsanjani is calling for the release of all the Western hostages held by pro-Iranian militants in Lebanon. The call was made in the Tehran Times newspaper, scheduled to be published tomorrow. Mike Theodulu reports from Nicosia.
Who knows, the paper said. Maybe 1990 will be the year for the release of all the Western hostages. It described them as victims of the West's imperialist policies and called on Muslim forces to work for their release without any preconditions. It was the strongest call from inside Iran for their release, and as such, it's certainly a positive sign. But observers say there's little doubt that, like Salman Rushdie, the hostages have become pawns in a power struggle at the top of the Iranian leadership between moderates who are seeking Western investment to rebuild the war-shattered economy and radicals who want nothing to do with the West. Today, a hardline paper praised the government for stopping an Iranian journalist working for the BBC. British officials should be alarmed, it warned, and could expect more retaliatory measures. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodulu in Nicosia.
Police in Colombia have seized a ton of heroin paste in two raids. Authorities say it's the largest amount of the drug found since the government started a nationwide offensive against the powerful drug cartels in August. On Wall Street, the Dow fell more than 13 points to close at 2583.56. This is NPR News. Federal safety officials are urging pilots and air traffic controllers to make sure they clearly understand each other when dealing with low fuel emergencies. Today's notice is to avoid crashes like the one that killed 73 people in New York last month. The National Transportation Safety Board, in an emergency recommendation arising out of the crash of Avianca Flight 52, said miscommunication between the flight crew and air controllers figured into last month's crash. The board said it's still investigating and did not blame the accident on either pilots or controllers. The Coast Guard has shut down the Drift River oil terminal in Alaska. The oil storage facility sits just 20 miles from Mount Redoubt volcano, and officials are concerned about a possible spill resulting from an eruption. Joe Gallagher of member station KBBI reports.
When Mount Redoubt erupts, it sends a torrent of glacial and volcanic debris into the Drift River. The overflow has spilled into the nearby oil terminal twice in the past month, knocking out power and damaging some buildings. The oil storage tanks tested, but the Coast Guard says the risk of continuing to store oil at the facility is too great. The Coast Guard has issued an order to the terminal owner, Cook Inlet Pipeline Company, to suspend operations until it can prove it has an adequate oil spill protection and response plan. The Coast Guard order is being appealed. Cook Inlet Pipeline President Jerry Durbin has sent a letter to the Coast Guard outlining procedures in place at Drift River to protect against the spill. For National Public Radio, I'm Joe Gallagher in Homer, Alaska.
Some economic analysts say they're alarmed about the January hike in consumer prices, which the Labor Department says rose 1.1%, but other experts say it's just a normal beginning of the year. A Chorus Line, the longest-running show on Broadway history, is closing at the end of March because of dwindling ticket sales. I'm Doreen McAllister, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Joe Kane's journey down the Amazon started with a phone call from a stranger. The caller hoped to be the first man to navigate the 4,200-mile length of the Amazon River. He was organizing an expedition and was looking for a writer to chronicle the journey. At the time, Joe Kane was writing for a San Francisco newspaper and for the Coevolution Quarterly. He decided to join the expedition. Kane was the only American on the 10-person team. Several members of the crew shook the little confidence he had. The leader of the expedition was slightly crippled from polio and had a reputation for sloppy planning. Another member had chronic brucellosis, a condition that often left him depressed, extremely lethargic, and feverish. One man was 52, had a degenerating disc and arthritic hip, and was overweight. Only Joe Kane and one other man paddled the full length of the river. Kane went on to write a book about the trip titled Running the Amazon. I asked Joe Kane what he expected his role would be when he joined the expedition as the writer.
At first, at least the way it was presented to me when I was going down there, was that I wasn't supposed to do anything. In fact, I was supposed to shadow the expedition by truck. There was supposed to be a big escort vehicle that would rendezvous with the kayakers every 2 to 3 weeks. And I was simply supposed to chronicle the expedition. I had no duties outside of that. However, once I landed in Peru, I realized that in essence, I had been sold a bill of goods. There was no expedition vehicle. Eventually, the man who was to later become the expedition leader, Piotr Malinsky, rounded up a Land Rover. Clearly, that couldn't hold me, and it couldn't hold the other expedition members it was supposed to carry. And we wound up hiking the first 150 miles of the river on foot, all in the high Andes up above 15,000 feet. At that point, my role in the expedition started to shift. Actually, it shifted right from the start in Peru in that I was assigned to help coordinate food supplies with another Polish man, Zbigniew Bizdak, who was our photographer. Later, when we got down into the big Whitewater Gorge, I was the quartermaster. I was in charge of making sure that we had supplies and that food was equally distributed and that there was no mildew in the bags and things like that. It was the lowest work on the expedition, without a doubt. But it became my means of establishing myself within the expedition and not simply as an outsider.
When you realized that you'd been sold a false bill of goods, why didn't you just leave?
That's a good question. Well, partially in a very crass way, I was on the hook. I owed these thousands of dollars to people, and I had made a deal with the publisher. But on a more, on a deeper level, I was in. You know, I had the bit in my mouth. I got sick right away in Peru, and as soon as I got over that, I started thinking, boy, I am in a different kind of place. This is my fantasy. I left home really on the run, and not sure what I was looking for, but just knowing that I was bored silly with my life. You know, I had a girlfriend, and we'd probably get married soon. I had a job that was steady, if nothing else, and fairly interesting. I was with the old Coevolution Quarterly, and it was a fun crew. But when I got right down to it, I was bored silly, and I realized that it was a matter of there just not being enough in my life that was raw. You know, everything seemed so cut off. So although the expedition clearly had huge problems from the get-go, we were flat broke before we even got on the river. At the same time, here was an experience that I couldn't walk away from, and, mm-hmm. and being a writer especially, I knew that there was a story there, and I wanted to chase it. It was simple as that, I think.
You got to the source of the Amazon high in the Andes, and that's where the official expedition began. But you'd already suffered through mountain sickness before you got on the Amazon. Would you describe what the source of the Amazon looked like to you when you approached it?
Well, for us, and I think for anybody, the source, you have to say it's more symbolic than real. You really can't point to a square foot of ground and say, this is where the Amazon starts. We climbed right to the continental divide, the South American continental divide, climbed to 18,000 feet. It was a high tundra, I suppose would be a good description of it. It was a glacier, or had been a glacier, and now it, with changing weather conditions, had degenerated to a snowfield. And we simply went over the continental divide, only a matter of a few hundred yards, and found an ice fall there, a frozen sheet of white ice, probably 25 feet high, and called that the source of the Amazon. It reached the proportions, or the extent that one of the guys climbed up on the top of the ice fall and spit over the side and said, well, that makes me the source of the Amazon. You can't narrow it down any more than that. And then the idea was to follow the runoff until it built a body of water that would support kayaks, and then from there to run it 4,200 miles out to the Atlantic.
Well, I guess as Joe Kane, author of the new book, Running the Amazon, well, you had to negotiate a lot of rapids along your journey through the Amazon. Would you describe the worst rapid that you had to run?
Sure. In a way, for 6 weeks, it felt like we were running one continuous rapid. I should describe just what the river does through there. It it drops that 18,000 feet in about 600 miles. And at one point, it runs through a gorge that's 10,000 feet deep, which is twice as deep as the Grand Canyon. It runs at a gradient of about five times the Colorado River through the Grand Canyon, all of which meant nothing to me. I had never been on a whitewater river. I had never been in a raft or a sea kayak. I had intertubed on the Sacramento River in California, trailing a six-pack of beer, and that was my vision of what it was going to be. I had even, you know, bought my Indiana Jones felt safari hat and my khaki shirt and all. But the rapids in the Apurimac, which is the furthest tributary of the Amazon, it is, again, the deepest land gorge on the planet. And the whitewater just comes in rapid after rapid after rapid, almost like a waterfall, a long, continuous waterfall. They got bigger and bigger until finally when we entered the deepest part of the gorge called the Acobamba Abyss, where the walls were 10,000 feet and just sheer. Sheer is the walls on the side of your house and quite narrow, sometimes only 50 yards across. That's where the whitewater really got crazy because there was simply no way that you could avoid it. There was no way out. There were no trails leading from the canyon. You couldn't climb out. If someone got injured, they'd have to be strapped on the raft, and we would simply have to run this gorge. We knew by that point that at least five expeditions had tried to run this area before. None had succeeded, and two had ended with drownings. One was a 1976 expedition, a West German expedition, well-financed, that the captain drowned 3 minutes after he got in the water. Once we got in the gorge, we realized that the 40 miles we had hoped to run in perhaps 5 days would take much longer. We were lucky to make a mile a day, and we cut rations to half and then down to a quarter. And at the same time, terrible squabbling broke out within the expedition. I had taken several swims. I took swims every day, which simply means that I was pitched out of the raft in a rapid, you know, bounced over the side one way or another. I was the left rear paddler. But boy, one day we hit a rapid that you could see it. It was a class 6, unrunnable. But there was no way around it for the raft. We couldn't portage it, and we just had to go. We shot the top okay. We got it in good position on the chute right above it, but then all of a sudden, I don't know what happened. Everything went black all around me. I was freezing cold. I just felt myself being sucked. And what I assumed was down, I couldn't even tell what was up or down. I could see no light whatsoever. I tried as hard as I could to swim, and I just couldn't. The water just pinned my arms to me. Something hit me in the chest, knocked all the air out of me, and then I just knew. I knew for a fact that I was drowning. I remember thinking quite clearly, this is it. I was a fool to come here, and this is what a fool gets. I was a dead man. And then like that, there was a moment of this peace and clarity. I kind of just gave up. I knew that there was nothing I could do. And then the river spit me out as if I wasn't good enough. And I bounced up, and I saw our lead kayaker, Jerome Turin, down below me, probably 50 yards below me, in his kayak, just waiting below the big water, and he just yelled, swim, and I couldn't even react. I was sucked back down again and bounced off the river. Everything was blackness, and I kept getting banged in the head. And I came up again, and luckily I came up right near Jerome, and he fished me out of the river, brought me over to a sandbank, and sort of deposited me there. He had to go rescue the raft crewman as well. And I just sat there and threw up for about 5 minutes. And then that night, it just came to me. I was sitting in that camp all alone and thinking, I don't know any of these people here. They have no obligation to me. If I drown, they don't have to go back to my family and friends and explain things. I was the only American. And that's when it really hit me. The only way out of there was to run that river, and I had to learn how to do it. And at the same time, the two Polish men, Piotr Zbyszek, came to me and said, look, we're going to make it, and we're going to make sure you make it. And that was it. The expedition split shortly after that.
So you had no choice? There was no way of walking away from this once you realized how dangerous it was?
No, not in that part of the river. There was no way out. That's when I knew this, you know, this wasn't Indiana Jones. This was the real thing. And I had better start paying attention or I wasn't going to make it.
Did you feel like a jerk then? You know, like, what the heck have I done? What have I gotten myself into?
I certainly did. But I should also say that I think I realized that was a useless thing to think about. Because uh-huh. Jerk or not, I was there.
Mm-hmm.
And I just had to pay attention. It was a feeling of you can't relax, you can't let go, because if you make one mistake, that's it. You know, watch what these guys are doing, see what they do, see how they react, talk to them, study, learn how to be on this raft. And so it became, in that way, it became very rewarding because it was a kind of discipline. And it certainly gave me that sense of, here's real life. This is the rawness I was looking for. And the lesson of it was, if you're in that kind of situation, you don't relax.
I want to talk with you more about this expedition, but first we'll take a short break. My guest is Joe Kane, and he was part of the first expedition to run the entire 4,200-mile Amazon River from its source to its union with the Atlantic Ocean. He was the writer there to chronicle the expedition, and that chronicle is his new book, Running the Amazon. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Joe Kane is my guest, and we're talking about running the entire length of the Amazon River. Well, the people on the expeditions ended up really at odds with each other, and the person who was the head of the expedition lost the confidence of the people who he'd taken along. This kind of came to a head when Odendahl, the head of the expedition, asked you to leave. What did he tell you, and what kind of deal did he try to strike with you?
Well, he tried to sell it as a package. It focused on me, but at different points up to then, it had focused on other people in the expedition, too. He had gone to various members and tried to get them out one way or another. We all sort of realized that what was happening was that once we got through the worst part of the river, he was going to try and force us off the expedition and narrow it down to perhaps three or two men, himself, his close friend Tim, and Piotr, because he had to take Piotr.
He wanted to narrow it down so there'd be more glory for him, or
I don't,
more food
you know,
for
I
him?
Really don't know. That was certainly the feeling among the other members of the expedition, that it was a very vainglorious sort of pursuit for him to attempt to get us out of there. And I think that's what caused us all to come together, because we really did stand up as a group and say, no, you are not the expedition leader anymore. It's our expedition. You're welcome to stay, but we're not going to follow these kind of rules anymore. They're not for the best of the expedition. And the man who really put that across was Jerome Turin. He was our best kayaker by far. He was an international champion. He was the one man who was never swept into the water, never really at the mercy of the river, and the man who saved all our lives again and again. He had known Odendahl. Their relationship went back many years, and he had seen this happen before. And he, once we were trapped and in bad, you know, in a bad situation, he came to me and to Zbyszek and to Piotr and said, look, clearly you guys don't know the history here, but there's a lot more going on than just us trying to get down this river. Francois is chasing some ghosts, and he will stop at no end to relieve his own inner burden. We mutinied. I think that's the only really way, real accurate way to describe it. Although Odendahl demanded a vote of confidence, and we gave him an overwhelming vote of no confidence, and he did leave the river shortly after that.
Well, several people left the expedition. Why did it break up?
A lot of reasons. We had planned to take 3 to 4 months on the river. After 3 months, we had covered a grand total of 600 miles out of a 4,200-mile river. Given that was the worst and most treacherous water, but still, we were so far behind. We were virtually flat broke. When you look at most expeditions, the budgets are, you know, million-dollar budgets or multi-million-dollar budgets, and I think we went all the way down that river for about $25,000. Everybody was tired. Nobody was terribly sick, but people were worn down. There was no doubt about that. We had been for 6 weeks, it had been literally every day. You'd wake up and you'd think, boy, am I going to make it through it today or not? And that the grinding that places on the personalities was it was a big factor, and people were tired. That's it. They just left for those reasons, I think.
So finally, there were just two of you who stayed on the river the whole time, who actually kayaked the complete length.
That's right. I should say, in fairness, it really was four, in that Zbyszek, our photographer, and Kate, our doctor, Kate Durant, who was also the only woman on the expedition, they said, you know, we'll stay, and we're going to go, and we'll carry the medical supplies, and we'll carry the emergency food, and we will drop it as we can in key places along the river so that you can get it, and we'll try and join up with you all along the way. But then, yes, it came down to Piotr, who is an Iron Man. I can't describe him in any other terms, really. He was going to make it one way or another. He would swim the river if he had to. But he asked me, he said, look, we've got two sea kayaks here. Would you join me? I don't want to do this alone. And I figured, in for a dime, in for a dollar, we've come this far, why not? So I said, sure, I'll do it, let's go. And we set off on a journey of 3,600 miles.
What was it like after being in a mountainous region and negotiating rapids for so long to hit sea level and placid waters and to be in the middle of the jungle?
The physical difference, at least for me, was that I was no longer in this mortal fear of for my life every day. But by the same token, the physical demands were much greater. We were paddling an extraordinary length. I had no idea. I had never been in a sea kayak, so I didn't know what it meant. And after the second day, I just sat there in my boat one day. I stopped, you know, it was 100 degrees out, and my head was just throbbing, and I was completely exhausted, and I calculated how far it was out to the Atlantic. And it was 3 million paddle strokes, which was, it made the act of executing a single stroke pathetic and almost useless. Physically and emotionally, it became a matter of adjusting to this routine over day after day after day, minute after minute, hour after hour. That was the most profound difference for me personally. But then the exterior was we were back sort of in the land of the living. Down in the big Amazon, there are villages. There are Indians of various types down there. And you do see, after a certain point, you do see other travelers on the river now and then. And in the big white water, we were completely alone. There was no way into that abyss and no way out of it. And people did not go down there.
What shape were you in when you finally arrived at the mouth of the Amazon where it meets up with the ocean?
I was underweight, I'll say that. I'm not big, I'm 5'10", 155 pounds usually, and I was down to about 135 pounds at that point. My wrists were inflamed. I had what is called tenosynovitis, and inflammation of the tendon sheaths in the wrist, a fairly common distance kayaking affliction. I was strong, but I was exhausted, frankly. And I would like to say that we reached the ocean with a sense of euphoria, but it wasn't that. It was a sense of, wow, well we did it. Let's go take a nap. The real euphoria didn't set in for a few months after we got home.
What did you do the day after?
The day after? Actually, we had television crews came out, Brazilian television, and we sort of reenacted the crossing of the ocean. But the most jarring event afterwards was that we went down to Rio de Janeiro. We were given free plane tickets. We were flat broke at that point again, as we had been most of the journey. And Good Morning America contacted us down there and said, look, we'll fly you home for free if you'll be on our show. So literally 3 days after we had been camping in the mud on the Amazon, we were touring downtown Manhattan in these limousines and staying in $300 night suites in the middle of winter. It was 6 below, and it was jarring. Kate and Zbyszek and I barricaded ourselves in my hotel room and got a big bottle of wine and a bag of sandwiches and just stayed there until we were on television.
That really does sound disorienting. Your job on this expedition was to chronicle it. Now, you know, you had hoped to come back and write a book, and that's what your purpose was. They wanted someone to write about the expedition. That's why they asked you to join.
That's right.
So I assume you were taking notes throughout the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Were you self-conscious when you were writing while you were on the journey? Like, what kind of tone should I strike here? After all, you were carrying the portable Conrad in your knapsack.
Striking dark and dark vision. I didn't even worry about it at that point. The real job, as I saw it, was to make sure I had the details down, just to get the notes down. I mm-hmm. made myself write 1,000 words a day, every night, even if it was just about the dirt under my fingernails, just to make sure I had something down when I came back. At first, it was exhausting, because I'd work all day. First, it was hiking all day, and then it was paddling the river all day, and then at night, I'd have to sit down and fill all these blank pages in my notebook. But after a while, perhaps after the first even 2 weeks of the expedition, when I was feeling particularly alienated from the rest of the people since I didn't really know them, the notebooks became my place almost of refuge. It was a place I went where I knew what my job was, I knew what I had to do, and I knew how to do it. And I could sit there and write and do the work. Sometimes it meant falling asleep with my face down in the notebook and waking back up again to keep on. But it really was something that I grew to like, to look forward to in the day.
How did you manage to hold on to the notebooks, considering you were almost killed yourself? You almost drowned.
It was, frankly, it was tricky. I showed up in addition to my, you know, my safari hat and my epauletted khaki shirt, I also showed up in South America with a waterproof briefcase, which I was roundly derided for. But once we got on the raft, that thing was a jewel. I could tuck my notebooks, and I had a tiny little micro cassette recorder, and my pens, and I could tuck them into the briefcase and tuck that in turn under the center net on the raft. And then whenever we got a break, I could yank it out and very quickly scribble down the notes, whatever my impressions were, snatches of conversation, descriptions, things like that. And then at night, go back and organize it into more of a narrative. So that became a very important tool. The other thing that I was really worried about with keeping notes was that they not be washed away and not be obliterated by the water. So I had the micro cassette recorder, and every 3 or 4 days I would read the previous sections of my diary into the micro cassettes, then wrap them in duct tape. And after a certain point, I was able to send a batch of those out by mule and back to the United States. And in fact, they all made it intact. And those were my backup notes.
That's really remarkable. Now that you're making a name for yourself from this book, Running the Amazon, in order to keep writing, are you going to have to go on more death-defying expeditions?
That's a shame, isn't it, when you have to you have to push it that far to get a book out of it. I'd like to write a book on adventure gardening, you know, how to raise really wild tomatoes, that kind of thing. I certainly would like to go out and be in a very wild place again. But on the other hand, I don't want to have that label of, oh yeah, he's just that fool who goes out and goes these crazy places. It's nice to be, well, to be every man, to be just a normal person and then put yourself in a really wild situation.
Oh, can we end on one of those big impossible questions? I really would like to know if you think any more or any less about death now that you're home safe and sound.
Frankly, no, not about death so much, but I do think about direct experience, I guess, for want of a better description. I really am convinced that the whole bent of Western culture is to veil experience, and I don't say that in a pejorative way, because who wants to feel pain? What kind of fool chases that kind of thing? But by the same token, I definitely feel that we've lost something. The culture really has no tradition of a walkabout or a vision quest or anything like that, as so many indigenous cultures do, where you remove yourself from your normal life and do something wild and then come back and live your normal life, knowing what the extremes are and what the boundaries are that are out there. So for me, while I don't think about death, I do think about, well, just how tame am I allowing myself to be, and how can we get out there and push that envelope, I guess, a little bit more.
Joe Kane, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Joe Kane's account of his trip is titled Running the Amazon. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, Tex-Mex, Zydeco, and Blues with Chris Drakwitz, founder of Arhuli Records. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Remember the three gray whales trapped in the ice of Barrow, Alaska in 1988? The person who first reported the trapped whales was Roy Amalek. Amalek is also a whale hunter, and coming up, he tells us how the native Alaskan's traditional whale hunt has changed over the years. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a perfect pairing, Haydn's Last Symphonies, conducted by Sir Thomas Beecham. And recently, Britain's Prince Charles made a push for preserving proper English. Our linguist Jeffrey Nunberg says the prince is confusing nostalgia with need. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Václav Havel of Czechoslovakia today spoke before a joint meeting of Congress. The playwright and former dissident spoke of political change and philosophy. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
President Havel expressed the hope that the transformation underway in Central and Eastern Europe would eventually allow American troops to return home. And he expressed understanding for the problems facing the Soviet Union, Czechoslovakia's former nemesis. The best way for America to help Czechoslovakia, Havel reasoned, is for America to help the Soviets on their difficult road to democracy. He said his experience under communist rule had given him one great certainty.
Consciousness precedes being, and not the other way around, as the Marxists claim. For this reason, the salvation of this human world lies nowhere else than in the human heart, in the human power to reflect, in human meekness, and in human responsibility.
Czechoslovakian President Václav Havel addressing a joint session of Congress today. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Following a recent government decision in Yugoslavia to put more troops into the troubled southern province of Kosovo, one of the first moves made there by officials was to put a curfew into effect. Pierre Vickery has more on the story.
Tension in Kosovo remains high after a massive show of strength by the Yugoslav armed forces. Jet fighters flew low over the capital Pristina, and columns of tanks and armored vehicles were out on patrol. A night curfew has been imposed and a stern warning issued of tough action against demonstrators. Despite the hardline policy, ethnic Albanians have continued their attempts to force political concessions. Most schools in the province remain closed. Many factories are out on strike, and a petition calling for multi-party elections is receiving strong support. A spokesperson for the Serbian minority has claimed that 2 million volunteers have vowed to fight, if necessary, to keep Kosovo inside Yugoslavia. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
Alaska's Redoubt volcano erupted again today, forcing the Coast Guard to close a nearby oil terminal. Ash rose to 30,000 feet after the early morning eruption and then fell over small towns across Cook Inlet from the mountain, turning snow on the ground to gray. In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down over 13 points to close at 2,583.56 on volume of 159 million shares. Trading was moderate. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. The composer Haydn is generally considered the father of the modern symphony. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says Haydn's symphonies may appear to be simpler and more straightforward than they really are. Lloyd has a review of some new Haydn reissues by the late Sir Thomas Beecham, which Lloyd says ought to be models for all Haydn performances.
Among the most popular works in the entire symphonic repertoire is the 94th of Haydn's 104 symphonies, The Surprise. Yet many of his greatest symphonies are not so well known. They certainly aren't played as often as the symphonies by Mozart and Beethoven they inspired. I think one reason for Haydn's relative neglect is that his symphonies are not as easy to play as they seem. At least on records, they have very rarely received the performances they deserve. Maybe the thing that Haydn is most famous for, his sense of humor, is what throws off many conductors. How can a work be funny and serious at the same time? So they either play down the jokes so they won't stick out, or they exaggerate them so the more serious elements of the symphony seem dull and pedantic in comparison. Maybe most conductors don't understand that one of the most essential qualities of Haydn's century is wit. If you look at some of the great 18th century writers, like Alexander Pope and Samuel Johnson, you can see that the texture of their work is a complex mixture of wordplay, jokes, and high moral and psychological seriousness. Pope can write with sly sexual innuendo, then in the next breath make you aware of the triviality of that same sexual game-playing. No wonder Haydn was so popular in England. His last 12 symphonies, which were among his greatest, were actually composed for London. So it shouldn't be surprising that one of the very greatest Haydn conductors of this century was a witty and sophisticated Englishman, Sir Thomas Beecham. Let's listen to this teasing selection from his 1960 recording with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra of Haydn's 102nd Symphony. What's most wonderful about Beecham's Haydn performances is the quicksilver way they slip back and forth in tone. The humor is rich and funny, but droll, understated. Beecham's elbow doesn't bruise your ribs. The seriousness is deep, but never ponderous, as in the profoundly tender introduction to the same Symphony No. 102. Among Beecham's greatest achievements are his entire series of Haydn's 12 so-called Salomon symphonies, which were named after the impresario who brought Haydn to London. They've been long out of print, but I'm delighted to see them reappearing on compact disc. Angel has released 2 CDs so far in their budget-priced Classics for Pleasure series, so now 5 of the symphonies are available, including The Surprise, The Clock, The Drum Roll, and The Miracle, which got its nickname because a chandelier is supposed to have fallen during a performance of it, yet no one got injured. The incident actually happened during the Symphony No. 102. Angel has also been issuing other wonderful Beecham performances on CD, including a heavenly album of early Schubert symphonies, and perhaps his most famous recording of all, The Magic Flute with the Berlin Philharmonic.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed two Haydn reissues with Sir Thomas Beecham and the Royal Philharmonic in the Angel Classics for Pleasure series. This is Fresh Air. Earlier this month, we interviewed Tom Rose about his book Freeing the Whales, How the Media Created the World's Greatest Non-Event. It's a report on how the media handled the story of the three gray whales trapped in the ice of Barrow, Alaska in 1988. After we aired the interview, we heard from several residents of Barrow who felt Rose misrepresented Barrow and their way of life. To get a sense of Barrow from the perspective of a native Alaskan, a couple of people steered us to Roy Amalek, a native Inupiat whaler. Malek was also the person who discovered and reported the three trapped whales in 1988. Commercial whaling is banned by the International Whaling Commission, but the Inupiats are allowed to continue their subsistence whaling of the bowheads. The commission sets an annual whale quota. The whaling season lasts about 4 months. For the remainder of the year, Amalek works for the school district. His uncle is the mayor of Barrow. We invited him to station KBRW in Barrow, Alaska, to discuss the traditional whale hunt. He told me he's from a whaling family.
My great-grandfather was, in fact, a good whale hunter, and my grandfather's brothers are, in fact, still whaling. They do catch a whale every year. And my father is a whaling captain, and he catches whales, and I am on his crew.
Who taught you how to whale, and how old were you when you started learning?
I was practically 10 years old. I started from the bottom of the crew. I had chores to do, wash dishes, make coffee, make sure that the stove is on, always on all night, and stuff like that. I've learned that since I was taken out on the ice, and I was told, you have to learn. And from there, I've gone to becoming a co-captain of my father's crew.
And when you talk about keeping the oven on and washing dishes, you're not talking about in the boat.
No, we're talking a different subject here. We always camp out on the ice. We have a tent, Coleman stoves, stuff like that. And we have grub boxes, which you call coolers. We do have those. We keep our food in there. And we do, in fact, live out on the ice for a period of 3 to 4 weeks.
And while you're sleeping out on the ice, you're watching for whales?
Yes, we have a set of two groups. One is the day shift and one is the night shift. There's nobody that goes to sleep all at once, so we're always constantly on alert.
How has whaling changed from the days your great-grandfather did it?
Back then, it was a lot harder to land, and it's a significant difference. We do have motorized snow machines more than we did. My grandfather did with his dog teams.
How is the boat that you use different?
The spring hunt we do use, there's no difference. We do use the same skin boats like they have for hundreds of years. We do paddle.
What about the weapons that you use to actually hunt the whale?
How have they changed
from your great-grandfather's time?
The weapons we use were brought up back in the late 1800s, which we do use as of today. We used the bombs, which we used with the harpoons and also with a shoulder gun. We have a projectile that we put in the harpoon, and it goes into the whale, and that sets off in the whale, and it slows down the whale. I know we used 3 bombs last fall to land our 45 foot whale.
So the bomb like explodes by the whale?
Inside the whale, yes.
How close can you maneuver the boat to the whale that you're hunting?
The whales we come right up to is within a matter of just less than 3 feet. We even sometimes come right up to the whale, practically bump into it.
Has a whale ever overturned a boat that you were in?
Not in the boats I've ever been in, no.
Is it very dangerous?
Certainly from an amateur's type where it is dangerous, and from my point of view, it certainly sometimes does get dangerous, but not a whole lot.
Have you ever been hurt?
Certainly I've never been hurt doing any kind of whaling up here, certainly not.
Have you ever been afraid?
No, I've never been afraid of landing bowhead whales.
Does the whale ever get very angry or ferocious when it realizes it's under attack?
Certainly not. We have been taught from a long time that whale that you are going to catch certainly gives itself to the people. That it's a long story. The whale just certainly comes up to the camp and offers itself. We do believe that in our culture.
Mm-hmm. And believing that the whale is offering itself, how does that affect how you approach the whale?
We do have a lot of respect for the bowhead whale. We have been taught from way back that in order for us to survive as a culture, we have to understand the lives and styles of and the movements of all animals. If we want to survive, we're going to have to understand the animals, the land, the sea. And I wish everyone would understand that we, as Inupiat people, have to survive.
When you learned how to whale, you were taught, though, that that the whale gave itself to the people. Do you feel that way when you're bringing the boat 3 feet away from the whale?
Yes, I've experienced that quite a few times, landing the bowhead whales. I've experienced that, and the emotions after the whale has given itself, the emotions are spectacular. We know for a fact that we will never go hungry for that season. We have food on the table. We have food to share, food to give. And we certainly do understand the whaling up here. It's from my point of view, it's something that I wish nobody would ever take away.
Mm-hmm. Is there a ceremony before the whale is butchered?
There's not a ceremony. We do have a prayer of thanks, and we do cut up the whale. We butcher it up. We distribute it to the following crews that are on the ice, which we have like a crew share, and they distribute it to their crew members. And then from there, the successful whaling crew that lands the whale, they do take a portion set aside for the community to come and eat at the residence, the crew that caught the whale.
What's the best part of the whale to eat, and how do you best like to eat it?
Certainly the best part of the whale is the whole thing. We do not waste one bit of the whale. The only part we leave back on the ice is the whale bones, the liver, and the lungs. That's all we ever leave on the ice. Everything is taken back. A portion of it is set aside for Christmas and Thanksgiving. And in June, we have a feast It's like a giant picnic outside where we do distribute part of the whale.
Are you worried about the bowhead whales dying out, becoming extinct?
I certainly believe that the bowhead whale will never be wiped out by the native people of Alaska. If there is to be any exploration of any oil companies out on the Beaufort ice, it certainly will not be the native people that extinct this boat whale. It certainly will never be coming from me.
For people who don't live far north like you do, it's very difficult to imagine what life would be like with 3 months of darkness a year. Can you tell me a little bit about how your life is different during those months when day and night are both dark?
When both day and night are dark, we do try and keep ourselves extremely busy during the winter months. Certainly, you have the ability to do a lot of things. I mean, you just can't be home, just staying home. You can go to the high school. What we have here, the swimming pool and the open gym where we can shoot basketballs and stuff like that.
Can you tell us a story of the most remarkable whale that you ever hunted?
The most remarkable whale in landing?
Mm-hmm.
It's always remarkable. You can't separate a whale from a different whale. The bowheads, you can't separate one bowhead like I caught last year and the bowhead I'm going to catch maybe this spring. There's not going to be any significant difference. It would always be a happy moment to land a bowhead.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Roy Amaluk spoke to us from KBRW in Barrow, Alaska. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, Václav Havel addressed a joint session of Congress in Washington today. How are you covering it?
We'll have a report about that speech. It was fairly philosophical in nature. He said, among many of the things, that Americans and Czechoslovakians need to learn how to put morality ahead of politics, science, and economics. Also, a report on AIDS in Brazil. We'll have an update on the campaign for a new president and assembly in Nicaragua. And tonight is Grammy Awards night. We'll examine one of the nominated songs in the country vocal collaboration category. It's called You Ain't Going Nowhere. It's an old Bob Dylan tune, first recorded more than 20 years ago by Roger McGuinn and Chris Hillman and the Byrds, and the nomination is for a new version.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Prince Charles has spoken on many occasions about his dislike of modern architecture, most recently in a TV special that aired on a lot of PBS stations. Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg says what's been less well-publicized, in this country at least, is the prince's equally emphatic dislike of modern English.
A year or so ago, Prince Charles made headlines when he complained to the press that his staff members were incapable of writing a coherent sentence and declared that the British schools were remiss in their duty. Not long ago, he renewed the criticism in a speech that was reprinted in the Manchester Guardian Weekly. Not surprisingly, Charles came down squarely on the side of tradition. As he put it, if you stand up and talk about the importance of our heritage and the lessons to be learned from our forebears, you are at once accused of having a quaint nostalgia for a picturesque, irrelevant past. Well, I'm not afraid of being considered old-fashioned, which is why I'm standing here at this lectern wearing a double-breasted suit and turnips to my trousers. That's cuffs to us. Charles went on, "The English language is an enormously precious legacy to be handed on carefully. We have rejected quality in expression, just as we have rejected quality in the buildings in which we work and educate. We have arrived at a dismal wasteland of banality, cliché, and casual obscenity." Charles is old-fashioned, of course. What else would you call somebody who still thinks it's démodé to wear cuffs and double-breasted suits? It's clear that Charles has never seen an episode of Miami Vice. But coming from him, the attitude's understandable. The prince has a vested interest in championing quaint traditions and antiquated institutions, after all. He knows where his crumpets are buttered. But it's more troubling when you hear middle-class American critics talking about the English language as if it were a kind of intellectual family china. A couple of years ago, for example, John Simon wrote, "There is a morality of language, an obligation to preserve and nurture the niceties, the fine distinctions that have been handed down to us." Of course, nostalgia is as old as change itself. I'm sure many of the early Druids viewed Stonehenge with alarm. What was wrong with the old wood one? And 200 years ago, you could find Dr. Johnson complaining, "The rite derived from ancient days, with thoughtless reverence we praise." But nostalgia is a particularly insidious form of regression, which distorts both past and present. A lot of my wife's architectural practice involves doing remodels of San Francisco Victorians. Her clients are beguiled by the chair rails and moldings and filigrees of those quaint old houses, but they don't want any part of the hives of interior spaces where the Victorians lived out their cramped lives. They want open family rooms with plenty of skylights. In language, too, we tend to see the past through the selective filter of literary memory. We form our impression of the English of the 19th century on the basis of Dickens and James, while the yellow journalism and sentimental romances of the period have been forgotten. In fact, it should be a consolation to realize that future ages will look back fondly on the language of the second half of the 20th century. If history's any guide, this will be known as the age of Bellow and Beckett, and not mercifully of Haig and Quayle. Of course we should esteem the legacy of the past. The danger is in letting veneration turn into fetishism. This is the mentality that's brought us the kitsch of Ralph Lauren, Laura Ashley, and architects like Robert Stern. And in language, it makes for the sort of writers who never use a slang word without putting quotation marks around it, and who go out of their way ostentatiously to avoid splitting an infinitive. As Dryden wrote in 1700, when he was attacked for rewriting Chaucer in contemporary language, words are not like landmarks, so sacred as never to be removed.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Amy Sallet and Phyllis Myers produce the interviews on Fresh Air with research assistance from Sue Spolin. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Chris Drakwitz tells us about his quest to record regional American music, Zydeco, blues, Tex-Mex. Drakwitz is the founder of Arhuli Records. Also, Timothy Busfield of 30-something tells us what he really thinks of his character, Elliot. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.